Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in El Paso Natural Gas versus Minco Oil.
May it please the court.
Judge Hankinson is not sitting in this case. I know that now.
May it please the court. Ms. Lynn Liberato will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner deserves 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I represent El Paso Natural Gas along with Allie Levy. The issue in this case is whether the UCC obligation of good faith prevents sophisticated business people from making a deal to release each other from liability. This case is not unlike the Schlumberger versus Swanson case that the court decided in the past year. It had, in that case, the court said a deal's a deal. And that's what we're seeking here, is to have the deal enforced. In fact, the facts here in many ways are more compelling than the facts in the Schlumberger case. Some of them are similar. These involve sophisticated parties who are used to doing the kind of deals that were done here. But even beyond that, the more compelling facts are that the Court of Appeals found that there was no evidence that anything that El Paso did, either in the written document or by their actions, caused the gas producers to execute these releases, to sign these releases. In addition, and perhaps most compelling of all, is that in regard to one of the producers, Minco, he actually approached El Paso to try to obtain the release.
One claim you have is there was no reliance?
That's right. There was no reliance. In other words...
And you claim that that alone would resolve the entire dispute.
Well, I think there are many things, there are many ways to approach it, but I think that...
What I'm asking specifically is, if we rule your way on reliance, will that resolve the entire dispute?
That they didn't rely?
Need to write on anything else?
Yes, Your Honor. Because what we're saying is that there was no causation. In other words, because they didn't rely, because the producers didn't rely on anything that El Paso did, that they couldn't have caused any damages. So that is indeed one of our arguments, one of several arguments that I think that are sufficient in and of themselves to cause a reversal in the case. Not only the issue that you ask about, Judge Abbott, but also two other things. One, that the Court of Appeals incorrectly applied the obligation of bad faith, or excuse me, the obligation of good faith to this type of circumstance when it does not apply here. And perhaps even more fundamental, the UCC doesn't even apply here because the contract at issue is the release. The purpose of release, of course, is to release liability. It's not a contract for the sale of goods. The release is not a contract for the sale of goods. Therefore, the UCC doesn't apply, and contract law applies. Common law contract law is what applies here. So for any of those bases, the Court of Appeals opinion is wrong, and El Paso should have the releases enforced, and there is no liability on behalf of El Paso. Let me go back for a minute and kind of break those down and talk first about the obligation of good faith, assuming the UCC applies here. What the court did, as this court may recall, is determine that there was no unconscionability on behalf of El Paso, but it went on to say that the releases were not enforceable because they violated the obligation of good faith. And then in the footnote, the way that the Court of Appeals resolved this was almost like making the obligation of good faith, if I'm even going to use this term, like a lesser included offense, if you will, of unconscionability, that the conduct could have risen to the level of violating a duty of good faith, but didn't rise to the level of unconscionability. But what the court did was incorrectly apply the two concepts, because bad faith is, or the obligation of good faith, is used to guide in the performance and the enforcement of the contract. Whereas in unconscionability is a concept that's used more in determining the properness of the enforcement of the contract. So to use the case that the Court of Appeals used, the Wentz versus Campbell Soup case, what happened there is that a court decided that a farmer didn't have to, under the contract, the Campbell Soup Company, if it didn't buy the carrots, the farmer couldn't sell its carrots to anybody else. And the court said that's unconscionable and it wouldn't have enforced that. So that's an example of unconscionability. It essentially takes away the, or removes the contract. It's like it makes the contract unenforceable. On the other hand, when dealing with the concept of the obligation of good faith, that then, the courts use the obligation to good faith to decide if there's a breach of the contract or if there is a right under the contract that it won't enforce. So there are different concepts, and the court incorrectly applied the obligation of good faith here.
As a variation on a theme, one of your arguments is that the court improperly applies good faith to the formation of the contract in this case instead of in the performance. You've argued about the performance. What authority is there that the 1.203, I guess, of the UCC doesn't apply to the formation, people using good faith in formulating the contract?
Mm-hmm.
Why does that not apply?
Well, it specifically says that it applies to the performance and enforcement. And then there is in the treatises that apply the UCC or that talk about the UCC, they say that just because that it is a different thing, that the enforcement and the performance of the contract is different from the contract formation. The authority comes in part from the wording of the statute itself, and there are treatises that say that. But they're just different concepts, and the way that the case is applied, like the Carrot case, just use them for different things and have different purposes in applying the two concepts. The other aspect of the case is whether the UCC should even apply at all. And just to elaborate a little bit more on what I addressed earlier, and that is that this is a new contract. And I have to be very forthcoming with the court that the parties and the lower courts have been a little bit, if I may say, sloppy in using the term termination, because there's confusion about whether there's a termination clause, which the obligation of good faith would apply to a termination clause. But this isn't a termination clause that we're talking about. There's not a termination clause in these contracts, the underlying GPAs. They just expired after 10 years. But instead, there's a separate agreement that is a termination. So my point is that the law and the cases that relate to termination clauses doesn't apply here, but the law that relates to an entirely new contract, which is what the release is, that does apply here. And I just caution that in looking at what sometimes we're probably not as careful as we should be to make the distinction between a termination clause and a termination, which is an entirely new contract. And therefore, for that reason, in addition to the other reasons we've discussed, the UCC does not apply. The last issue that I will mention briefly and perhaps is more appropriate during rebuttal, but that is the waiver issue and the determination that the Court of Appeals made on rehearing that El Paso waived its claim, its challenge to the trial court's finding in regard to one of the parties, in regard to Dornbach. What happened there is that the trial court only found that there was unconscionability, not bad faith, and then on appeal, of course, the Court of Appeals determined that there was not unconscionability. So on rehearing, the court said that because El Paso didn't challenge the trial court's failure to find that the underlying release was in fact a release, that we waived our ability to make that challenge. There are several answers to that. I think the most basic of which is that the trial court did not rule against us. It just didn't make a ruling. In addition to that, the Court of Appeals determined in its initial opinion, and we agree that the that the release was unambiguous, and so therefore it's a matter of law, and the court could decide it. And it really only became an issue once the Court of Appeals determined that unconscionability didn't apply, and we raised that as a property.
Well, if you had challenged that, would that have made a judgment more beneficial to you than you got from the trial court, since the trial court made no ruling whatsoever?
It would not have. It would have made no difference to the judgment itself. The judgment was...
So it makes no difference one way or the other?
Well, it does make a difference ultimately, because once the Court of Appeals took away the reason that the Court of Appeals, that the trial court held against us, then the issue is it actually released? Does it release all liability? So that sort of opens that issue at that point. It didn't become an issue until the Court of Appeals made its determination.
Well, isn't an argument made, or was it made, that be that as it may, even if you didn't have to preserve it at the trial court, that your brief didn't argue it or support that viewpoint with authorities?
Well, we did argue it on rehearing at the Court of Appeals, and that's really only whenever it became an issue. It wasn't an issue until the trial court held in our favor. The Court of Appeals held in our favor.
Okay,
so that's why we didn't raise it until later. For those reasons, unless the court...
Well, let me ask you.
Yes,
assuming that we agree with your argument, what effect does that have then on what the Court of Appeals did? I'm not clear on that.
Okay. The effect that has on what the Court of Appeals did then is to reinstate the release, and then because the release is in place and the only adverse finding to us in regard to the release was that it was unconscionable, and the Court of Appeals said that was wrong and that as a matter of law it wasn't unconscionable, the release is then in place, and so therefore there's no liability as to one of these two parties, Dornbos, because the release is proper and in place and not unconscionable. So that would be the effect of that. It would be to reinstate, I'd say it another way, to reinstate the original opinion of the Court of Appeals as it relates to that one party. Our overall policy point in this case is that people should be able to contract away their liability, and that's what happened here. So for that reason, we ask the court to reverse the judgment of the trial court and render that the producers take nothing.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. John Smithy will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. The opinion that came out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals was one of the best and more thoughtful opinions that I've seen on the issue of good faith. And I think as the court gets into the authorities, deep into the authorities that recognize the White and Summers types of authorities that discuss code law, it becomes apparent that the Court of Appeals opinion is entirely consistent with the body of mainline code law, and that the position that El Paso takes would be truly an aberration of the law. It's different from anything that's expressed in the body of law. Now, this Court of Appeals opinion has already been cited. It's less than a year, about a year old, actually less than a year old. It was, in fact, cited by this court in the original Northern versus Conoco opinion. It was taken out on the opinion on rehearing, but the proposition was still the same. The case has already been picked up by Professor Kramer in the part of Texas practice that he writes for in the supplements. And so it's a well off-cited opinion that is entirely consistent with code law. Now, the first thing that I really should do, and let me tell you, these charts are about as worn out and beat up as I am. They've been through the weather and everything, but there's a difference here in the Minco case and the Dornbos case. They're the same gas, and I don't know if you all can read this, but it might help a little. They're the same gas contract, basically. Pretty much the same set of facts, but there are some material differences. Okay, and I'll start with Minco over here. There was an original gas purchase contract. In 1984, there was an amendment that effectively lowered the price of gas to be paid and also reduced the amount of gas to be taken under this take-or-pay contract. The trial court found that that amendment was both bad faith and unconscionable. The Court of Appeals reversed its unconscionability but found the amendment was still in bad faith and so refused to enforce it. There were a number of monthly release letters that the trial court found to be both unconscionable and bad faith. The appellate court reversed as to unconscionability but refused to enforce based on bad faith. The same is true of the ultimate 1989 termination letter, which the court found to be unconscionable and bad faith, but the Court of Appeals let remain standing the bad faith fact finding, and by doing that, refused to enforce it. So that's what happened in Minka. Now, Dornbos is a little bit different. It's identical up to this point of this 1991 termination letter, so-called termination letter after the contract had already terminated in 1989. They sent out a letter and said, we want to terminate the contract, even though it had already terminated. And the trial court did not make a bad faith finding on that. I don't know why the trial court didn't, but it didn't. But it
expressly refused, right?
No, it just wasn't mentioned on bad faith anywhere in the record. In fact, when we raised it on rehearing, the court basically said, well, you've already got what you asked for, so there's no need for it because the court had found unconscionable. When I prepared this, I left off something very important. The first reason that the court refused to find the 1991 termination letter and to refuse to enforce it was because the court found it to be ambiguous, specifically found in conclusions of law that it was ambiguous. So, first of all, it says it's ambiguous, so we're not going to enforce it. And secondly, it's unconscionable, so we're not going to enforce it.
Now, I thought you said it already terminated anyway by its own terms, so you don't understand why they sent the letter. So what's the significance?
The significance of the letter is that even though the contract had terminated by its own terms, as this letter said, we will terminate the contract if you will agree to waive any past take-or-pay liabilities that might exist, or any past liabilities. It didn't say take-or-pay. It said if you will waive any past liabilities that might exist between the parties. Well, El Paso came into court and said that was a release of take-or-pay obligations. The court said, well, you've got an ambiguity, first of all, because of the words. Well, it didn't say this, but you have, the court didn't say this, but you've got a language that suggests a waiver, which is UCC language, and you've got El Paso contending it was release, and you also have a situation where take-or-pay isn't even mentioned. So the court said it's ambiguous, and so we're not going to enforce it as a matter of law. At that point,
what other relationship other than a take-or-pay agreement did the parties have?
That was it. And that's the only contractual agreement the parties had was were the take-or-pay contract to purchase gas.
So I'm not sure. I mean, if waiver or release or whatever, what else is there out there that your client could have waived other than whatever was going on between them in the take-or-pay agreement?
Well, you know, a take-or-pay contract is a contract for the purchase of gas.
Well, I know what it is.
I understand.
It's not quite what else is out there that you could say made this ambiguous that you'd be looking at you were waiving. I'm not clear on that.
I'm not sure. To answer the court's question, it's just a purchase and sale of gas over a number of months, and you've got amounts that are due from the party for the mm-hmm. purchase of gas.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that it is ambiguous or not ambiguous. What I'm saying is the trial court found it to be ambiguous.
I understand.
And
but
point,
you're arguing, therefore, it was unenforceable because that's what the trial court found.
Yes.
Well, but I don't understand why if an agreement is ambiguous, that makes it unenforceable.
Well, if you put cases of this court together, first of all, the courts say that we will not enforce a contract unless the meaning is clear. The definition of an ambiguous contract is one whose definition is not clear. Now, the proper procedure when a court makes a finding of ambiguity as a matter of law is for the party with the burden of proving the contract to go in and prove as a factual matter the meaning of the contract, which becomes a fact issue for the fact finder to decide. I mean, that's just the Hornbook contract
law. But in
law.
The Dornbos, the trial court declined to do anything. Is
no.
that correct?
No, the trial court just said it's unconscionable. But even if we were to adopt your interpretation, I'm sorry, they said it's ambiguous, but even if we were to adopt your interpretation, it's It's unconscionable. And so El Paso can't just sit on its hands at that point. El Paso can elect it to not do anything else in the trial court, but when they appeal that, they've got to raise error on both of the adverse findings that precluded them from their defense on that contract. They've got to tell the Court of Appeals the trial court was in error in finding this contract to be ambiguous, and the Court of Appeals could address that. But that what I'm telling you is that this 1991 termination letter was never even mentioned in the Court of Appeals. You will not find any reference in their brief to this letter. You will find no reference to any conclusion of law that mentioned or dealt with this termination. It was never even mentioned. In fact, by implication, it was excluded from the brief. And they made absolutely no complaint. They didn't tell the Amarillo Court of Appeals that the trial court erred in finding it to be ambiguous or in finding it to be unconscionable.
Well, I understand by your answer then that the waiver language, the only thing it could apply to if you waive any liabilities of El Paso would be the take-or-pay contract.
No, not necessarily, because in an ongoing gas purchase agreement, there are price adjustments, things of that nature, that occur over the extended period.
But they all arose out of the take-or-pay agreement.
They all arise out of the take-or-pay agreement.
It's a basic agreement between the parties.
Yes. Actually, we call them take-or-pay agreements, but what they really are gas purchase agreements that contain a take-or-pay provision. Mm-hmm. And it's primarily a gas purchase.
Let me ask you a question on the unconscionability is, I understand that concept,
yes.
Saying this contract between these parties, for whatever the basis was, are unconscionable, therefore they're not enforceable. I have a hard time understanding the concept of good faith. These parties who are in this contract, one of the parties decides this isn't a good deal for me and goes to the other side and attempts to negotiate a release and to get out of the contract.
Yes.
And the other party agrees. Now, how does the concept of good faith fit in here? What duty flows from the party who's asking for a release to the other side that somehow affects whether the other side agrees or does not agree?
That's the issue. And the duty is honesty and facts. That's the code definition of good faith.
What does that mean? Does that mean I have to tell them that I'm not negotiating with others about this, or that I have to tell them what prices I'm getting from other people for releases?
No.
Or what?
I think basically it means you have to tell the truth. You can't lie. In this case, El Paso flat lied. They just lied. And what they did was, now if El Paso had come to these provisions,
that'd be like a misrepresentation. That would be more like fraud and inducement. You misrepresented facts upon which I relied in executing the release.
Well, you know, and I'll talk about reliance in just a moment, but it's honest. El Paso could have gone to these producers and said, look, we're having a hard time, gas prices down, you're under no obligation to reduce your price and reduce the purchases we have to take, but we're asking you to do that. And that would have been entirely truthful, and it would have been entirely proper, and they could have agreed to do that. But El Paso, that's not what El Paso did here. El Paso goes and says, we can't take your gas. We cannot buy your gas next month. Now, the evidence at trial showed they could have bought the gas. They had the money, they had the resources, they had the pipeline space to put it in. That was a lot.
Did they have customers?
They could have bought the gas, and I'm sure the record, really, there isn't any real record evidence on customers. I know the market.
Where were they going to put it after they bought it?
Well, that's the point of the take-or-pay contract, is that
they could have paid for it. They may not have been able to physically take it, but saying they could have paid for it, not taken it.
Well, they said the evidence is they had space in the pipeline to take it.
Well, space to take it is one thing. Where do you put it when you get it on the other end of the pipeline?
Well, the only evidence is they could have physically taken the gas, and also they had the money to purchase it. Now, that was false when they said that. The other thing they said is that we cannot take your gas because of market conditions and federal regulatory requirements. And El Paso admitted at trial there were no federal regulatory requirements that prohibited them from taking the gas. And so then they went on and said the purpose of all this is to the purpose of that, a federal regulatory requirement, because that, and El Paso admitted that clearly invoked the force majeure clause of the contract, which would excuse El Paso's performance. And so That's what they're in effect implying is we can't take your gas, so we're excused from the contract.
When were these representations made?
Pardon?
When were these representations?
Every single month in the monthly release letter. It's in every letter that was sent every month.
Up through the end of the contracts.
And there were no federal regulatory requirements. And so the producer is put in a situation where El Paso's not buying his gas. They're not paying take-or-pay damages. They won't let him sell to any third party. He's in a box. He can't do anything. He can't sell his gas to anybody.
They could succeed, couldn't they?
If they had known the truth. But there's a duty of good faith in a UCC contract because you're entitled to rely on what the other party tells you. And back in the real world in those days, I do a lot of oil and gas work. I'm on the Energy Committee in the House. I've written energy bills. I didn't know what the FERC regulations were. I knew some lawyers I could ask, but I mean, the real world, it was a confusing mess back in the 80s. And so they rely on El Paso. If they had known they had a cause of action, sure they could have filed suit. But they were entitled under the duty of good faith to rely on what El Paso said, and they did. And so then El Paso goes on and says, the purpose of all this is to maximize your revenue. Well, that was false, because El Paso then turned around and had some options and they as to what they did, and they would always do what hurt the producer the most. And so what happened is the producer ended up giving away hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars, of contractual rights over a period of several years because they trusted El Paso to do the right thing.
Ms. Smithy, why isn't the good faith and general requirement of the UCC simply a gap filler to fill in areas where in essence, to make the operation of the contract be reasonable as opposed to creating an independent cause of action? And let me give you an example. Unconscionability. There's a separate good faith provision that deals with outputs and requirements contracts. And it seems to me it's used in that context to be sort of a gap filler. We recognize that this contract is sort of open-ended, but we're going to use this to really tag on sort of a reasonable approach the parties will take. Why isn't the good faith at the beginning not really to be a cause of action? Good faith is not the mechanism by which you sue a party for something that's less than a breach of contract. If you've got a breach of contract, you've got a breach of contract. If you don't have a breach of contract, you don't. But it may be that because this doesn't constitute a breach of contract, there may be a basis for arguing that it ultimately was there's a mechanism to require the party to be reasonable in their approach to the contract. How does good faith get you to a point of voiding this agreement when you can't get it by unconscionability? It's not unconscionable.
The court found it wasn't, and they're two different things, two different measures, two different elements for unconscionability on one hand and bad faith on the other. But that's a good, we're not alleging bad faith as a cause of action here. And if you read the comment to 1203, the good faith duty section, you read the section, there is a duty of good faith in the performance and enforcement of all UCC contracts, okay? I mean, this court has said that over and over. The comment says that doesn't create a specific cause of action or a special cause of action, but instead it may deny rights that would otherwise be available to parties. All of your commentators, White and Summers, Anderson, Hawkland, all of them, say that when you have a bad faith amendment to a contract, a bad faith termination, a bad faith waiver, a bad faith compromise and settlement, anything that relates to the performance or the enforcement of the contract, the duty of good faith applies, and if the duty of good faith was violated, then that agreement is unenforceable. The court should refuse to enforce it. That is just standard, common Hornbook law. And in fact, in the Northern Natural case, this court cited the comment to 1203, and that's exactly what it says. And so we're entirely consistent with the comments and the commentators.
So your point is that the releases are not independent agreements. They're not novations.
Oh, no.
You're saying the good faith that you're talking about applies to the gas purchase contract.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the main
and
point.
And that was violated by their effort to get you to enter a new contract.
Yes. Anything that relates to the performance or enforcement of that original contract is covered by good faith. And in this case, what it was, I mean, they weren't trying to enter into a new contract. El Paso was trying to avoid performance under the first contract. That's the whole point of this. First of all, they were trying to amend their obligation down. Then they were trying to terminate that obligation. Then they were trying to release parts of that obligation. That's all it amounted to, was El Paso's attempts to avoid and escape performance under the original gas purchase agreements. There was no new contract here. This is clearly a UCC case. El Paso tries to make some argument that because the court found, did not, the Court of Appeals didn't find unconscionability or reverses to that ground, that that would somehow compel a reversal as to bad faith, but that's not the case. Bad faith is a fact issue. Unconscionability is a question of law. The court reviewed the bad faith findings based on a sufficiency of evidence, factual sufficiency ground, and found there to be factual sufficiency. There was no legal sufficiency evidence in the Court of Appeals. There is absolutely no evidentiary challenge before this court. It's simply a legal challenge.
You said earlier that El Paso should have told the truth and not lied, and that they should have disclosed that they were just not going to be able to continue to honor all these take-or-pay agreements. Was that the truth? They wouldn't be able to?
Oh, they could have honored it. I mean, they might not have been able to physically buy all the gas they'd contracted for, but from a financial standpoint, they could have paid the take-or-pay, and that was the purpose of take-or-pay.
All of the contracts they had, all of the take-or-pay agreements they had, they could have honored them?
I don't know if there was any evidence along that line, but there was certainly no evidence that they couldn't have honored our contract if they had wanted to, or if they'd been willing to keep their word.
Should we draw a distinction between the modification to the contracts and then your release of claims?
Technically, a waiver or a termination is not a modification under the UCC definition, but the doctrine of good faith doesn't just apply to modifications, although it clearly does apply to modifications. The doctrine of good faith applies to anything that involves the performance or enforcement of a UCC contract. So
once you sign a release, I mean, shouldn't you have to be required to show fraud in the inducement of that release, not simply that you didn't know everything?
No, not in a UCC case, there's a duty of good faith.
So you're saying in a UCC case, you can set aside a contract, a release agreement, a straight-up release of causes of action against someone, even if there's no fraud in the inducement. It's a lower threshold.
That's what the commentators say. And this isn't my opinion. This is what the unanimity of commentators say, is that if you have bad faith, whether it's a modification, a termination, it's compromising.
This isn't a termination. This is a release. It's unilateral. I mean, it's bilateral, not just a unilateral termination. This is a knowing waiver of any claims and causes of action on your client's behalf.
Yes.
And you're saying that if there's there's a non-disclosure that doesn't rise to fraud, as long as there's some bad faith that you get out of that release. That release is voided and set aside.
The bad faith, if there's a fact finding of bad faith, yes, under the code, because there's a specific duty of good faith.
Where does the code deal with releases?
Well, the
releases
code.
Releases of causes of action, claims and causes of action.
I would answer that by saying that it's in 1203, where it says that the duty of good faith applies to everything that has anything to do with performance or enforcement of the contract. The commentators and the comments have taken, and specifically the comment to 2209 that deals with modifications, makes it clear that that deals with any attempt by any party to escape its duties under the contract, no matter whether you call it a modification, a compromise, a release, a waiver, or termination, or what. If you have a specific duty under that contract and you use bad faith to escape performance, it doesn't matter what you call it. It's a violation of bad faith, and the courts do not enforce those under the main body of Uniform Commercial Code law.
If we had a straight-up release that was separate and apart, and there were no modifications to the contract, the parties just sat down, and El Paso said, I'm going to pay you $10,000, would you give me a release? And your client did. Would you say that that's still subject to being set aside merely on showing of bad faith?
It's subject to the duty of good faith because code provisions are unique. Parties are entitled to rely on other parties in code transactions like they are in normal arm's length any other type of transaction, and it's so that commercial commerce can flow without having to go hire lawyers and do background check and check out all the facts. I mean, that's the purpose of the code. And if you have bad faith, you've got a fact issue as to whether that agreement should be enforced or not. A party can't use bad faith and then come into the court and ask the court to enforce their bad faith agreement under the code.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, this is a separate agreement. The release is not a modification. It is an entirely separate agreement. There is no authority that supports the contention that it is governed by the UCC. The UCC does govern modifications. This is not a modification. This is a situation where, in regard to Minko, it's particularly significant. He came to El Paso. He is the one that approached El Paso and asked for the release. In regard to Dornbo, the contract had already expired 2 years earlier whenever El Paso sent him and many other of its producers releases. This was an opportunity for El Paso and particularly for Minko to be able to get out of the contract, to be able to go their separate ways, to settle their agreement, to have the opportunity on Minko's behalf to be able to sell its gas to British Petroleum, which is undisputed in the evidence. That's why the company wanted the release, and for El Paso to be able to release itself of its obligations. There is no fiduciary relationship between contracting parties in this type of situation. And essentially, that is what the producers are asking this court to find. There is a special relationship. Judge Baker asked the question in another context, what was their relationship? Their relationship was one and only one, and that is of contracting parties who were seeking to get out of the deal that they had made and who resorted to a new contract to do that. Parties should be able to do this. It is beneficial to both sides to know that they can find releases. If El Paso were faced with a law that said that you have some kind of special duty to them, it would obviously be much more reluctant to sign the release, because it gave up things as well as got things in the process. And so for releases to be viable, people should be able to enter into them. This was an arm's length transaction, and there is no reason under the UCC, which I do not believe applies, and certainly not under contract law. There was a request, I should mention, by the plaintiffs. There was a fraud claim that the court found that there was no fraud here. And so absent that, these releases are valid and they should be enforced.
But in the agreement, these releases were executed on a monthly basis.
That's correct.
Now, I suppose the parties could have modified the agreement to say no money would be due under the pay provision if they didn't take it. Now, that would have modified the agreements, clearly.
I think they were modifications, Judge. There are two things we're
talking
about.
But if they're modifications, then aren't you stuck with the good faith requirement of 1.203?
For the modifications. But the modifications, there were two types of things. If they went along, there were monthly release letters and a mandatory agreement. And I agree that those documents were modifications to the contract. But that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about are these ultimate agreements, these ultimate releases, one done in November.
The termination
agreements. Those are separate releases. So I would agree that if all we had were those monthly agreements, that it would apply, that the obligation of good faith would apply. I don't think it would work here, but I'm saying that it would be a principle that the court could apply. But as the Court of Appeals held, and I think the facts show, these two final termination letters were separate releases. They were not modifications.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.